English translation by Prabhupada. My Lord, you are the best of the Brahmanas, especially because you are fully aware of the Jyotish Shastra, the astrological science. Therefore, you are naturally the spiritual master of every living being. This being so, since you have kindly come to my house, kindly execute the reformatory activities for my two sons. I'll just go straight to the purport, I think. Prabhupada's purport. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, says in the Bhagavad Gita, 14.13, Chatur Vadyam Maya Sristam Guna Kama Vibhagasa, the four Varnas, Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Sudra, must be present in society. The Brahmanas are required for the guidance of the whole society. If there is no such institution as Varna and Ashram, and if human society has no such guide as the Brahmanas, human society will be hellish. In Kali Yuga, especially at the present moment, there is no such thing as a real Brahmana, and therefore society is in a chaotic condition. Formerly there were qualified Brahmanas, but at present, although there are certainly persons who think themselves Brahmanas, they actually have no ability to guide society. The Krishna Consciousness Movement is therefore very much eager to reintroduce the Varna Ashram system into human society so that those who are bewildered or less intelligent will be able to take guidance from qualified Brahmanas. Brahmana means Vaishnav. After one becomes a Brahmana, the next stage of development in human society is to become a Vaishnav. People in general must be guided to the destination or goal of life, and therefore they must understand Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The whole system of Vedic knowledge is based on this principle. But people have lost the clue. Nati vidur svastha gatimhi vishnum, Bhagavatam 7531. And they are simply pursuing sense gratification with a risk of gliding down to a lower grade of life. Michu samskara vatmani, Gita 9.3. It doesn't matter whether one is born a Brahmana or not. No one is born a Brahmana. Everyone is born a Sudra. But by the guidance of a Brahmana and by samskara, one can become Dvija or twice born, and then gradually becomes a Brahmana. Brahmanism is not a system meant to create a monopoly for a particular class of men. Everyone should be educated so as to become a Brahmana. At least there must be an opportunity to allow everyone to attain the destination of life. Regardless of whether one is born a Brahmin family, a Kshatriya family, or Sudra family, so on, one may be guided by a proper Brahmana and be promoted to the highest platform of being a Vaishnav. Thus, the Krishna Consciousness Movement affords an opportunity to develop the right destiny for human society. Nanda Maharaj took advantage of the opportunity of Garga Muni's presence by requesting him to become the necessary reformatory activities for his sons to guide them towards the destination of life. That's a big purport there. The verse again. My Lord, you are the best of the Brahmanas, especially because you are fully aware of the Jyotish Shastra, the astrological science. Therefore, you are naturally the spiritual master of every human being. This being so, since you have kindly come to my house, kindly execute the reformatory activities for my two sons. Om Agyanam Tiridam Dasha Dhanangala Shlakaya Takshuho Minitamina Tasmai Sri Gurve Nama Sri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Sapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Garamayam Tavasiva Pantikam He Krishna Kruna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopisha Gopi Kanta Radha Kanta Demoshtate Nama Om Vishnupadaya Krishna Sarai Bhutale Smati Bhatranam Swami Jinamine Namaste Saiswata Devi Gurdavan Vishane Nivasesha Shunyavadi Vishatade Starini Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nichananda Siyadvaita Karadha Siva Sadi Gurdavat Vinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. So it looks to me, sounds to me, there's certain main points made by Prabhupada here, which I'll briefly summarise. First of all, it of course is the sacred nature of the Brahmins and how that fits into the top of the Varna and Ashram system, the Varna system. Also, of course, is reference to Garga Muni as a great astrologer, which I mentioned as well. And also, perhaps Prabhupada's main point as well is the fact that being a Vaishnava automatically means you are on the Brahmin level if one follows properly, of course. So in the context of this, of course, Nanda Maharaj, he's just got baby Krishna there and Balaram, of course. Nanda Maharaj has been visited by Garga Muni. And Nanda Maharaj thinks, aha, good that you're here, because you can bless the child and you can also do an astrological reading. Garga Muni was actually known as being expert in that. He was one of the great forerunners of what we recognize as astrology. So he was known as a great astrologer. Garga Muni himself, although a brahmana, he had a Kshatriya mother, interestingly enough, which meant that traditionally he could not he would be brahmanas for fellow Kshatriyas. He was a Kshatriya brahmana. This, even within, generally we think, oh, brahmana vaishya, actually there's subdivisions as well within the different varnas that we don't often think of. In other words, there's a lot more room for flexibility in the ancient Vedic system than we think of. For example, if someone's a chariot driver, just like Krishna's a chariot driver was a sudra occupation, but you're working in the satra environment, you're on the battlefield driving a chariot, so therefore you are a sudra, but you're actually working for the satrias. So in a non-dissimilar way, we see here Garga Muni was a Brahmin, but he was essentially serving the royalty and the satrias rather than the Brahmin caste. But in those days, I think also it's significant to mention here, especially given the purport, before the Kali Yuga, this system worked a lot more efficiently than it did today. Today, as Prabhupada mentions, no one is born qualified. Therefore, everyone has to earn the qualification to be a Brahmin or indeed anything else. But whatever Varna and Ashram one is in, a Varna in this case, it's one's natural inclination, not by birth, but by one's own personal qualification. If someone's mom and dad are both doctors, one may be a doctor when they grow up because of parental pressure and genetics and so forth. But one is not a doctor until one's become qualified on one's own merit, not merely because one's parents are doctors. So especially in the Kali Yuga, where it's assumed that everyone is born at the bottom and they have to work their way up. But obviously what's also very, very prominent in the purport here is the important role that brahmanas would play in Vedic society. They were at the top. And this is an interesting point, I think, because the whole point was that the brahmanas had actually had authority over the kshatriyas. Even Lord Ram, and Prithu Maharaj, and Yudhisthira Maharaj, all these great maharajas and kings of the past, they were actually subservient to the brahmanas. If they had a big, big decision, should we go to war, or whatever we have to do, or how much taxes should we collect, whatever major decision there was made by a kshatriya, they couldn't really, they had to get it through the Senate of Brahmanas. I'm not sure if Senate is the right word, but the Brahmanas would play the ministers, but also the councillors. So essentially they were in control. They were the top. And people knew that. The Kshatriyas may have had more wealth, certainly more material wealth. They had the palaces, they had the crowns and the cloaks and the jewels. And the Brahmanas were just above and beyond all that. But the funny thing was, if you imagine an exemplary society where people knew that beyond that, beyond the riches, beyond the wealth, beyond the power, the material power actually, was actually the Brahmin caste. And that's very, very important, because that's completely lost today. The Brahmana's role, of course, was to samskaras, was mentioned in the purport. There's up to about 14 samskaras, rites of passage through one's life. There's a mundane ceremony, or there's the Brahmin initiation ceremony, and so on and so forth, funeral rites, marriage rites. The Brahmanas would perform all of these, especially those in Brahmin caste, because they would perform all the 14 samskaras, whereas Vaishya would be less, Sudras would be less than that. She said, Ada Goklananda Ki Jai, Shishi Sita Ramlaksam Hanuman Ki Jai, Shishi Gornitai Ki Jai. So this essentially was the ancient Vedic system, where the Brahmanas were superior to that of the Kshatriyas. The Kshatriyas, of course, would do the work, they'll be the politicians, the ones who get their hands dirty and do the real work, but under the guidance of people whose priority was spiritual life. And in that way, they set the direction of society, you see. So they were at the tip of the arrow. They're actually a small minority as well. It's not that there was like 90% of the population were brahmanas. No, they're actually quite a small percentage. But just like the tip of the arrow or the tip of a spear is the smallest part of the spear, but actually it's the most effective part of the spear as well. So you've got this long, long handle, But actually the spear part is the part that penetrates the material energy, and that's the brahmanas, you see. Without that, you would have a lost society, just like Prabhupada actually mentions. For example, today, politicians are answerable to the Vaishyas, the global corporates. You know, look at American politics, for example. It's not the caste system or the class system, it's the cash system. Where the you like that one, don't you? Yeah. So the idea, of course, is that class system basically empowered European imperialism, actually. And cash system seems to be the rule of law today, where the leaders, politicians of any country, really, are not subservient to the brahmanas or those brahmanically inclined. Like that. So therefore, human society is like a big, big body without a head. The brahmanas, of course, being the head, setting the direction in society, making valid spiritual judgments, and ensuring that Vedic culture remains intact. Take away the brahmanas, as we have a situation today, and you may have a strong body, but you're headless. Therefore, you're going to cause havoc everywhere. And Prabhupada himself mentions that. He said it would become a hellish society. A hellish society where no one's actually got anywhere to go. No one knows what to do. And thus, as leadership degrades as time goes by, even satrapies won't have, even politicians won't have any control at all. Prabhupada mentions in the Bhagavatam 7.5.31, purport, it says, persons who are strongly entrapped by the consciousness of enjoying material life and who therefore accepted as their leader or guru a similar blind man attached to external sense objects cannot understand that the goal of life is to return home, back to Godhead, and engaged in the service of Lord Vishnu. As blind men guided by another blind man miss the right path and fall into a ditch, materially attached men, led by other materially attached men, are bound by the ropes of fruitive labour. So basically in Prabhupada's purport here, he's more or less saying this is the society as it is today, where people don't really know where to go, and people get more and more entangled in their complex cities, thinking that, oh, if we do this, if we're more liberal, we'll all be happy, and we'll be liberal, and we'll be spiritual. Then someone else will come along and say, no, we have to take the right-wing measure, we have to kind of build fences around ourselves and protect our society. But what society are you protecting? The point is, no society will be worth protecting and preserving unless it's a spiritual one, and it cannot be a spiritual one unless the heads of society are spiritual people, guiding the politicians. Because politicians, even if you read the Mahabharata, for example, you know, the kingly, they were in the mode of passion, actually. Rulers and satrias are not in the mode of goodness as much as the brahmanas. The satrias need the brahmanas to calm them down and say, all right, okay, let's just do some prayers, let's do a yagya, and we'll sort it out that way. We're not going to sort it out on the battlefield just yet. That's an absolute last resort. So the brahmanas are there, characterized by patience, humility, tolerance. If someone doesn't have these qualities, humility, goodness, tolerance, self-control, charity and so forth, well, receiving charity, actually, then one cannot call oneself a brahmana, even one if it's born in a so-called Brahmin family. Prabhupada said these things are by personal qualification alone and not by birth. So it is opposed to the what is known as the caste system, as I mentioned earlier. What Prabhupada is suggesting for ISKCON's agenda is actually to promote the true Varna system. Like that. For example, some might ask, well, how does that apply today? How does someone working in IT, what are they? Are they brahmana? Because they're kind of smart people in IT. They're satrias as well, because they're administrators. And they're vaishyas, because they're probably working for a corporate or something. And they're sudras, because they're getting paid. So how does it work out? And I personally think that, as Bhakti True Swami once said, I put up my hand during a class and I said, well, how do we implement Varna in today's society then? And his response was just preach Krishna consciousness. Was the response. In other words, we've probably got a long way to go. We've probably got a lot of groundwork to do, because society is so far away, actually, from this ideal society that Prabhupada describes, that a change of consciousness of society itself is necessary before I think any strict kind of application or ambition is there. But suffice it to say, people do not listen anymore to priests or those that you call of the Brahminical order. You know, it's seen as being religious life in many cases is seen to be irrelevant or at worst even a threat to the economy. If too many people renounce, if too many people are Brahminical-like and start living in hermitages and bhajan kutirs and so forth, then what's going to happen to the economy? They won't be shopping at Primark and therefore keeping people employed and so on. It's a real mess, actually. So the politicians have to deal with these things. And they are, as the Bhagavatam quote said, it's like the blind leading the blind. No one really knows what to do. They think more and more modernization or more away from actually Vedic family values, gender roles. They think if the more it goes away from that, the more better everything will be. But actually, I don't see that at all. Anyway, so other roles that brahmanas would play, you know, ministers to others, the performings of rites, performing, obviously, pujari work, of course, maintaining deity worship, living, working in temple environments, that would be theirs. And, of course, even if you look at small English towns and villages today, you'll see a place of worship is at the centre of that town, and then everything else builds around that place. And especially in India, but also even in everywhere across Europe, you see there was a church, and then there'll be the everything else would be built around the church. Everything now is built around the shops. So therefore, the brahmanas would be, of course, living near or within the temple region. That would be the centre of society, not the market. The market was important, but actually it was the temple, the mandir, that was the centre of culture and society, and the brahmanas made sure of that. Of course, another major role they had was they were indeed astrologers. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about Jyotishastra. There's one or two astrologers among us, actually, so I'm a bit humbled, but I'll try and talk carefully here. So in this case, in the verse here, we learn that Nanda Maharaj says, now you've got to do the chart for Krishna and Balaram as well, if you don't mind, and get out your chart, find, oh, yes, very auspicious, I see, you know. And that was a tradition, that was the culture. And the understanding was, it's not that everything is set in stone, but it was to give general guidance. Oh, I see, well, this person's inclination is, or this person's going to be very good at making money. Oh, yes, 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 that's good. Okay, so maybe, you know, the parents will bear that in mind, and if this astrological prediction manifests to become true, then okay, well, maybe we'll get him in business, or whatever it might be. But the idea was, it was ingrained into society for a role for the brahmanas, actually. The Vedas, there's six supplementary Vedangas, which basically means like ritualistic scriptures, of which the Jyotishastra is one of those. Of course, Vedic astrology, a bit different from Western astrology, but the similarities, everything ultimately comes from the Vedas anyway, in its original form. I think in the West, it's been since the 80s where people started to know about Vedic astrology more. Hang on a second. Of course, yeah, there was other aspects as well, like astrology also used for making decisions about marriage compatibility charts, prospects for the future, opening new businesses. Oh, yes, well, they would even do that as well. The Vaishya caste, of course, would be saying, oh, yes, yes, opening your new store, better in January than February, because January there's a bit of Rahu happening here. And so, in other words, the brahmanas would guide them according to the planets and the sun and the moon, especially to find out what was the most auspicious time, or even the date of marriage, the day of marriage, the time of marriage would also be guided by the brahmanas, or moving into a new home. And it was indeed taken very seriously. Lord Chaitanya had his birth chart done, of course. I mean, his own uncle, I think, did that. And Srila Prabhupada also, one of the first things that Prabhupada's parents did was bringing in an astrologer to read Prabhupada's chart, Abhay Charan's chart. And the astrologer stood up and said, he's destined to open 108 temples around the world. So this gives you an idea of the bona fidity of some aspects of astrology, not all. But it seems to have a quite a solid foundation. Although Prabhupada wasn't too keen on devotees getting too much into that, which I'll mention in a moment. Most devotees will probably know something about astrology, Vedic astrology, but just in summary, for everyone's interest, because it confused me for years, you know, what do you mean by a house? You know, so houses are, it's like imagine this, the sky, the visible sky is divided into different segments. And of course, at the time of birth, you take a camera shot there, and all the different planets would be in different segments or houses in the sky. And according to those combinations, of course, and the meanings or inclinations of those planets and how they interact with each other, you get a reading. For example, the mind, the moon would be tend to be like mind and emotion, Saturn more towards austerity and sloth, Venus was more passion, femininity and relationships and love sometimes, Mercury, intellect and communication, Mars, of course, even in Greek mythology, the god of war or aggression, Jupiter was the guru planet. That's a gross simplicity, because in astrology, sometimes the way that the planets interact with each other in their respective houses can also have a retrograde effect, where they have the opposite effect as well. So it's all rather complicated. It's a science. It's a mathematically science. And there's many different things. I won't go into it, but again, marriage compatibility charts, for example, Vana, Vaishya, Tara, Yoni, Graha, Gan, Bakut, and Nadi, representing different inclinations of that particular person. Their personal relations, their destiny, their mental compatibility, social relations, life's destiny, physical compatibility, and so forth. So when doing a marriage compatibility chart, you'd put those two together, and you'd find out how much they've got in common. And essentially, generally, the more in common they would have, the more points out of 36 they would get. And if you get over 18 points as a couple, then people generally say, oh yeah, that's all right then. But I would suggest it's a bit of a little bit, for someone to do that, those type of charts, reducing it to merely numbers, it seems to me to be a little bit too cold. And therefore, it was understood that, and the reason why there are not many bona fide astrologers around today, is that the astrologer needs to be practically self-realized and highly qualified to do a proper chart, not just reading off numbers off a list or printing something off the internet, etc. But actually, there was a science to go with it that was mathematical and so on, diagrammatical too. But at the same time, it required a certain level of consciousness, high consciousness, of brahminical qualities of the actual astrologer, him or herself. For example, there would be no good going into... I'll tell you stories. In Brooklyn, I went to see an astrologer. I was going through a difficult time. And I don't know why, just the devil inside me went into this non-devotee place, and there was a lady there. I think she was Brazilian or something. There was a cigarette and... okay, that's $5. In other words, it was bogus, basically. And there's a lot of what's the word for it? There's a lot of bogusness out there, and non bona fide readers and astrologers and so forth. But then again, it's not to say that every single astrologer is bogus, not at all. But the point is that just because someone claims to something, you can't take for granted, because it's combined with one's spiritual profile as well, and behavioural traits too. One should at least be a brahmana to actually, a brahminical inclined, act like a brahmana to actually even begin getting into astrology. At least that's my understanding. Interesting enough, one of the original astrologers of one of the propagators, the prologue, great astrologers, of course, is Bhrigu Muni. There's a whole story about that. Do you want to hear that? It's about brahmanas and astrology. Okay, so you imagine long ago, millions and millions of years ago on the higher planet somewhere, Bhrigu Muni and other Munis and great demigods would have arguments between themselves. Big, big kind of debates. Who was supreme? Shiva, Brahma, or Lord Vishnu? Because they were all great. They were all greater than them. Well, Brahma is the creator, they would argue. He must be the one that is supreme, because he created this entire universe. You don't mess with Brahma. He's up there. And someone say, about Lord Shiva? He has the power to destroy. He's the most merciful. He's non-different from the Jivas. He's an incredible personality. And then someone else would say, no, it is Lord Vishnu. He's lying there on the causal ocean. Lakshmi's massaging his feet. He is supreme. And Bhrigu Muni, I think Bhrigu Muni kind of knew that Vishnu was supreme, because Bhrigu Muni was Bhrigu Muni. But the other said, all right, then prove it then. I think Lord Shiva is supreme. And someone else said, no, it's got to be Lord Brahma. So then Bhrigu Muni went on a mission. He said, all right, I will test them. I will test Brahma, I will test Lord Shiva, and I will test Vishnu. And we'll see what happens. To a non-verbal offense, a verbal offence and a physical offence will be performed. Again, it was pretty brave doing this, I think, Brigamuni, to be honest. But anyway, he says, I'm going to perform these offences to these personalities, and whoever reacts the most brahminically is the supreme, and he's the object of worship for the demigods, for the Vaishnavas, rather. So Brigamuni, he kind of, you know, obviously must have been quite brave. He goes to see his dad. He goes to Brahmaloka, the abode of Satchaloka, the abode of Lord Brahma. Brahma is sitting there, and Brigamuni just walks into, you know, Brahma's palace or wherever he was, and completely ignores him, which is pretty rude. Imagine you haven't seen your dad for some time, and he goes, oh, hello, Nandan. And Nandan's like, that would be an offence to your father, wouldn't it? Or your mother, or any relative, really, or your best friend. It's a bit of a snub. So that's what Brigamuni did. He actually offended Lord Brahma with a non-verbal offence. He didn't respond to him, didn't talk to him. And Lord Brahma was pretty angry. Remember, he's predominated by the mode of passion. It needs passion to create. He's the predominating deity of the mode of passion. He was going to, you know, get out his pots, and he was going to curse Brigu for this offence. And Brigu had to do a runner. So the next destination, of course, was to Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva, Mount Kailash there. He thought, okay, I'm going to take it a step further. I'm going to perform a verbal offence to Lord Shiva. I tell you, Brigu was no coward, that's for sure. So there was Lord Shiva with his snakes around his neck in Mount Kailash in meditation. And Brigamuni appears on the scene. And Shiva turns around, oh, hello, Brigu. You know, Brigu says, look at you, you know, you've got bodies covered in ashes from dead people, you know, from the crematorium, your hair's all matted, you don't even comb your hair, and, you know, you've got a snake around your neck. I mean, look at you. And Lord Shiva, understandably, was pretty offended at this. He started doing his dance of the Nataraj. He got really angry. Again, Brigamuni had to make himself scarce. In other words, Lord Shiva, he's a predominating deity of Tamagun, actually, and therefore he got angry very, very quickly. Finally, of course, he goes to the milk ocean, and he goes to the abode of Lord Vishnu. And there is Lord Vishnu, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, lying down there, resting, of course, and Lakshmi was there massaging his feet. There you go. And Brigu thought, this time I've really got in for it, this time I've got to perform a physical offence, which is even worse. You know, non-verbal, verbal, those are bad, but physical offence, oh goodness me. So he swallows his pride, I suppose, and there's Lord Vishnu and Lakshmi Dev. They turn to Brigu. Oh, hello, Brigu. Braces himself. He goes up to Lord Vishnu and gives him a jab in the stomach with his foot. And Vishnu's like, how does Vishnu react? Vishnu, he turns around and he goes, oh, sorry, I hope the hardness of my chest didn't hurt your soft lotus feet. It's good to see you. Good to see you. I'm sorry if I got in your way. I must have intruded on your feet for you to do that. But welcome, welcome. Please make yourself at home. And Brigu is, wow, Vishnu, he's surely in charge, of course, maintenance of the universe, which is predominating deity of the mode of goodness. Surely Vishnu is therefore supreme. And he came to that conclusion quite rightly. But that's not the end of the story. Because then Lakshmi, you know, she was a faithful wife and very attached to her husband, as you understand. And she wasn't quite as merciful, I don't think. So there she was, massaging Vishnu's feet. And suddenly Vishnu gets a kick in the stomach. And Lakshmi, she's fried. She's really fried. She thinks, well, my husband may have forgiven you, but I will not. A very, you know, protective wife, you see. She says, no husband of mine will be kicked in the stomach, she thought. I will curse you. I will curse not only you, I will curse all the brahmanas. You will always be poor. I will never give you my mercy. Because she was Lakshmi Devi, you see. So therefore, the brahmanas, even today, are cursed by Lakshmi. They can never really become wealthy or amass wealth. They're not allowed. They're supposed to rely on charity, actually, from the other varnas, particularly the kshatriyas. However, as years went by, it became difficult for the brahmanas. We thought, how do we make? We've got to make some money. We've got to feed our families. We want to get married. We want to have kids. And so astrology was understood to be one of the gifts to the Brahmin caste, actually, as a way of making Lakshmi, a bona fide, a Brahminical way of making a living. So I thought that was kind of connected there. Brigu, he gave his predictions on different types of horoscopes compiled by him with the help of Lord Ganesh. in a brief and concise manner. The total possible horoscope combinations I've read is about 45 million. I don't think it's possible to have any more than 45 million horoscope combinations, but that's enough. That's enough. That's about the population of England or something like that. I just also wanted to talk about... What time do we finish, by the way, today, Nandu? Maybe in 10 minutes? Oh, thanks. He's performed a verbal offence. No, I'm only joking. Okay, so let's say five, 6 minutes. Okay, all right. Everyone's there going, oh, no. Okay, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur was actually very good at astrology, actually, and astronomy, for that matter. He was SE expert. He even went as far as doing commentaries and translations and what they call apologies on the Surya Siddhanta and the Siddhanta Shunamani, which are actually astrological works as well as astronomical works. However, he did give that up because he wanted to concentrate purely on Bhakti. Because especially in the Kali Yuga, it's difficult to get it all to work. But the whole point really is that being a Vaishnava, in the same way that being a Vaishnava in one sense automatically covers being a Brahmana. Similarly, being a devotee of Lord Krishna, being a Bhakti Yogi, as it were, being a devotee, covers what one's being, in other words, more one advanced one is, the closer one is to Krishna, the less one is influenced by the planets, because the planets are ultimately material things. It doesn't mean to say that people are not influenced at all by them, but it's... You know, Krishna has the... Once Prabhupada actually said that Krishna has the power to flick away Rahu with his little finger. In other words, Krishna can supersede the influence of the planets. But nevertheless, the basic structure still may be there to some degree. But Bhaktisiddhanta gave that up and, of course, concentrated on preaching the glories of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And I think that's significant. But he did actually... I'll talk a little bit about the Surya Siddhanta because that was important, because it was significant enough, I think, for Bhaktisiddhanta to actually translate and to write a treaty about. According to the Sanskrit text itself of the Surya Siddhanta, it was spoken by a messenger from the sun god to the Asura Mayadhanava. It was translated into Bengali by Bhaktisiddhanta, which is what's similar about the Surya Siddhanta. In many ways, it's not dissimilar to what we call modern astronomy. In the sense, in terms, it agrees, for example, with the sizes of the diameters of the different planets in the solar system, as well as the Earth, Sun, Moon distances as well. Which is quite interesting, because the Srimad Bhagavatam, the fifth canto of the Bhagavatam, and the astronomy that is in there, astronomy being different from astrology, astronomy, the study of the planets, is very different in the Bhagavatam than it is in the Surya Siddhanta. Which is quite an interesting thing to think about, and I won't get into that today, for another time perhaps. But the point really, I think, is that the Bhagavatam is the vision of the celestial beings, or those in higher levels of consciousness. The Surya Siddhanta, being more common with the modern calculations, remember, was spoken to Mayadhanava, who is essentially a demon. So the materialistic or the gross vision of the solar system matches what we know today is the solar system. Whereas the Bhagavatam, descriptions of Bhumandala, different planetary heights and so forth, is a higher vision, a celestial vision of the demigods. So what I'll do there, I'll finish on that point. What I wanted to do to finish off, perhaps, I'm sure Nandan will be very happy, is talk a little bit about Nimbarka Acharya. Because today, it's his appearance day, is observed and celebrated, I believe. And what we'll do, I'll just talk for a couple of minutes on that, because I'm no expert, to be honest, on him. However, then we'll have a couple of questions, if necessary. Is that okay? Yeah? He was actually a 13th century personality, although some sources actually also suggest he had former lives or from former yugas and so forth. He actually was brought up to worship Lord Shiva, but obviously he worshipped Lord Shiva to a very, very high standard, it seems, because Lord Shiva, back in the 13th century, actually appeared to him and asked Nimbarka to, okay, well, I advise now you go and take initiation from the four Kumaras. And of course, being a very, very elevated being, Nimbarka had the power to see that the four Kumaras were actually meditating not far away in the mountainous region. So he went there, he was able to converse with the four Kumaras and took initiation from them. And therefore, obviously, he became a personalist. But his philosophy was slightly different from Achintya Bhedabheda Tattva. Remember, he's from before Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And his philosophy really was duality in unity. Duality being perhaps slightly bigger factor. The four Kumaras gave him the Radha Krishna mantra, which is Radha Krishna, Radha Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Radha Radha, which is quite interesting, very similar in some ways, of course, to the Hare Krishna mantra. So in the same way, this is like the predecessor, perhaps. And the things that his teachings would have in common with Mahaprabhu, from Mahaprabhu who actually took a bit of Ramanuja Sampradaya, a bit of the Madhva Sampradaya, including, of course, a bit from Nimbarka, of course. But what he took from him was the emphasis of taking shelter from Radharani and the fact that the gopi's love is the supreme. So this type of this feminine love of Krishna as being the highest type. But as a result of that, we find that there is, again, the philosophy of being duality emphasized more than unity, but duality in unity. This was different. You've got to remember at the time, the teachings of Sankaracharya was very, very prominent throughout India. The idea that everything is one, there is no duality. So to become a dualist was quite a breakthrough at the time. But all this, of course, was in preparation for the teachings of Mahaprabhu, the inconceivable simultaneous oneness and difference between Krishna and the living entity. Okay, I'll stop there. Any questions about perhaps the verse or the purport?